Okay, good morning, everybody here and on Zoom. So today we are going to continue our discussion and study of karma with chapter 10 from the book I've been using. And we've been studying karma for the past few months now. And this chapter I find very useful and relevant to us because it deals with how meditation handles karma, how meditation can help us actually put to rest some of those repetitive patterns, right? So, well, two things, to meet the patterns in Zazen and to learn how to quell the power of those patterns, right? So to get in touch and also to examine how we use our meditation practice, right? Are we actually doing this? Or are we using our meditation as a way to perpetuate karmic patterns? So I'm going to read, as we have been doing, read a bit and open it up. Our view throughout this book has been that the purpose of discussing karma is to present a way of using karma as a path, rather than regarding it as something that we should struggle with, whether for or against. So instead of trying to cultivate karma or trying to diminish its force, we could use the karmic situation as a path. As a result of situations in life that have already occurred, we have ended up being what we are now. Our present state of mind, our present spiritual development, and our domestic scene have been karmically determined up to this point. So as a result of situations in life that have already occurred, we have ended up being what we are. Our present state of mind, our present spiritual development, and our domestic scene have been karmically determined up to this point. The birth of further karma constantly occurs through the ongoing reliving of the past. We reproduce our nest, ground, or home, so we can function continuously. Therefore, the practice of meditation is the only path that can work with the karmic situation, with karma as such. Karma, in this case, is the psychological continuity of impulse, emotions, and the subconscious mental processes that go on. These processes feed on themselves all the time and develop themselves further, constantly, on and on. Unless there is a way of not feeding the subconscious mind, not feeding the neurosis of the mind, there is no way of preventing karmic situations. It doesn't matter whether we are dealing with good karma or bad karma. Both amount to the same thing from this point of view. The attitude of spiritual materialism or being goal-oriented and wanting to enrich our ego, enrich one's purpose and become better than what one is the expression of subconscious gossip. In other words, ambition is further feeding of the karmic situation. It sows further seeds of karma. Even if we are sowing seeds of good karma, we are nevertheless still encircled in the samsaric fortress. So from this point of view, meditation practice is a way of stepping out of the karmic situation altogether, transcending both good and bad. It is transcending psychological materialism as well as spiritual materialism. So in the beginning, when we first practice meditation, meditation is part of spiritual materialism. That's the only language we seem to know at the beginning when we first enter a practice. Actually, quite a while after that, too. And it is goal-oriented, purpose-oriented. That particular sense of purpose could be used as a stepping stone. In other words, we should not regard the whole karmic mechanism as something bad, something that breeds further confusion of samsara. When a person hears of such a thing as meditation, he hears that if he relates to his physical situation as well as psychological situation in a certain disciplined way, he is going to get the answer or she hears that from meditating, she is going to get better. Through meditation, she is going to get better, having less pain from this point of view of neurosis. That starting point seems to be inevitable. We can't bypass or ignore that as being unsophisticated or as not being at the complete job. In other words, there's no perfection at the beginning. We have to start with our imagination, impulses, and concepts. The desire to be saved, become enlightened, or even develop basic sanity, those ego-centered types of mentality have to be included as stepping stones. So in the beginning, the meditator does not cut through karmic roots, but uses that perpetual karmic situation as a stepping stone. We begin on that level. So, a question, is that clear, what he's saying here? Is it clear? Is it relatable? Do we understand what he's talking about? Now, he's saying at the beginning, we shouldn't get caught up in the beginning, and now I've been doing it for a while, therefore I'm not. We do get caught up in what he calls spiritual materialism, right? And it's not different. It's different in terms of what we're running after, but it's not different in terms of the one who is running and chasing and wanting something, right? Whether I want to have a big, incredible house, expensive house, or great experience of enlightenment, it doesn't matter. I am chasing. And most importantly, in both situations, I feel a sense of lack. And the sense of lack is what's driving me to go chase after something, which means that I'm perpetuating a sense of not having enough or not being complete, right? So that's a question for us to look at. Where are we at? So maybe you want to share in a few sentences, few words, your experience or experiences of spiritual materialism. And if you don't understand, ask. I'll explain again. Go ahead.
Yeah. This is in some ways been a at the heart of a certain kind of struggle that I've had with it, in so far as I've slipped back and forth of, like you said, coming from a place of lack, I've often gone like, oh, I want more than what I have, or I notice when I'm shrinking myself, I that's compensating, and that's responding to the spiritual materialism in a certain way of like, oh, we're supposed to rid ourselves of attachment, or he's saying, so I'm just going to shrink myself down so much. And I think that we've spoken about this before in regards to, it's very easy to interpret what we talk about in our practice as a form of passivity or even nihilism, and it's really hard to understand what we're doing as an active form of realization, and the realization, and it's also hard to come to terms with the fact that the realization of these things is not realizing we don't have them and we have to go acquire them. It's realizing they've been here this whole time, and we have to open up to that.
Right.
That's something for me that often slips in and out of, I feel like I'm like always just trying to, like, it's like a TV antenna, I'm trying to catch the right signal for the television show, and sometimes it comes in super distorted, sometimes it comes in and it's just static, and it's always going, it's not okay, I have it now, and I'm good now, I can coast. And I think that returning to that beginning is crucial and important, and it's important to not see that as a step backwards or as a step forward or anything.
Right. We can be attached to not wanting, right? And it's, again, not different than being attached to wanting, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, I want to not want, right? So there is a hidden want in that.
Right.
Right? I want to not. I want to be, right? So, but again, it goes right back to a sense of lack, right? I am not. I'm lacking. Now, what he's saying here is that, and it's an important point, that we shouldn't feel like there's a problem with that, right? He's saying that that's natural. That's how we think. We can't avoid this way of thinking, right? Our society, the way we grew up, this is what we are taught, right? You know, have some goals and chase your goals, mm-hmm. right? That's it, right? And which is fine by itself, but underneath that, chase your goals and achieve them, because you're, otherwise you are a loser and you're not complete,
right?
Or whatever, right? Otherwise you're not worthy. Maybe that's better, right? You're not worthy, and your worthiness will depend on what you have to show for at the end, whatever that is.
That also, too, can be joined up with like a real difficulty of understanding it when we say, like, at the end every time, you know, you chant, like, do not squander your life.
Right.
We associate chasing these things as living life to the max, and if you're not doing it, and if, God forbid, you have a lazy day, you're squandering your life, you know. It's the sun's out, it hasn't been out for 7 days, and yet you're right. Sitting inside, you're squandering everything, you know. It's kind of interesting,
right? So then we have to examine the meaning of not squandering.
Mm-hmm.
Is it location based? Is it activity based?
Right?
We have to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. What is it based on? Right? So, what else? What else? Please, yes. Just project your voice because the microphone.
I'm thinking about why I've come back to this. I mean, and I've been kind of preoccupied in my mind when I've been reading the one book, Suzuki's book about right intention, mm-hmm. right effort,
mm-hmm.
and I'm asking myself, do I have those things? Do I even know what those things are? You know, and so I don't.
Right.
You know, I just know that I guess I'm sick of being in my head, sick of suffering. I mean, I don't know, but
right.
I don't, I don't know what right effort, right intention is, or whether I need to know, or, and I guess that's maybe what the part of this is trying to say, is that it's okay, you know.
Right.
So I,
it's okay,
that's
what... Right, it's okay, but more than that, actually, what's really important is that you ask the question, right? You ask the, whether you ask it verbally, right, loud, or you ask it internally, you're asking the question, right? You're not saying, I need to know, right? So that's a very important point, right? So what are we looking at? What are we talking about, right? So you're talking about intention, right? So what kind of intention is it? If the intention doesn't have a future idea in it, right? So it kind of collapses the way we view intention, right? Intention, well, the word itself also means to reach out, right? Intended, it means to actually extend your arm and reach out, right? Reach out to what, right? What are we doing, right? So when you sit down and you meditate, right? The hallmark of practice in Zen, right? Zazen is to actually get comfortable being where you're at rather than do it as means to an end, right? And that's what he's talking about at the beginning. We do it as means to an end, right? It's a vehicle, we call it, right? The great vehicle. It's a vehicle to get me from here to there. Fine, I get that. Now we have to ask, what is here and what is there, right? And that's a very important question to ask. And it's not something to go look for an answer, but just to keep the question open and to ask, maybe to ask even if there is a difference between the here and the there, or between where am I coming from and where I think I'm going. Is there essentially a difference? Not just facade or the way it looks, but deep down, right? Essentially, is there a difference, right? Because in terms of practice, we are sitting to realize, right? To realize what already is. That's what practice is about, right? So if you sit to realize what you are, how could it be somewhere else? It makes no sense, right? Because you already are. That's Buddhism 101. You already are that. You are complete. We begin from completion, not end with completion. So we have to turn around and go back, not forward, right? So it's a matter of recognition, realization, right, as we call it. So now, but that being said, what he's saying here, we have to use the mind that wants, and we have to learn to quell it, calm it down, right? Give it something else, not give it more food for wanting, but calm down the wanting. Right? That's the difference. But yeah, the question is very good and very important. Yeah.
I was also thinking, since you brought that up, not knowing what right effort is, right intention, that's, I don't think anybody does, really. I think you have to experience that. I think that's an experiential thing, right? Like, in this moment, what's my intention? And what would benefit others the most? You know, and not just myself. And so as soon as you turn to service for others,
mm-hmm.
that becomes, it becomes just like a living intention or a living correctness, if we want to say it that way. But it's not even that. It's more like, in this moment, how can I serve others? And what best serves others? And doing that, and then experiencing that, and that isn't labeled anymore.
Right. So right. So what if the intention, what about having an intention to be here, right? What about that, right? Can that be, can that replace the intention to become, right? To arrive elsewhere, right? Can we turn it around and ask, how can I raise an intention to stick around? What does that look like? Right? Because if I raise the intention to stick around, I am working with this, right? So I am not, and if I do that, I am not perpetuating karmic patterns, right? Because it's not about continuation, right? It's about being, right? So you step, that's what he's saying, it's stepping outside of that continuation of pattern or perpetuation of pattern, right? So you step outside of that and then you raise the intention of, I want to be here, this, right? How do I do that, right? And then that means basic instruction meditation, right? What we talk about often is a thought comes, don't hop on, don't follow. Don't follow, right? Don't go anywhere. Come back. Or if you do go, come back, right? So if that's right intention, right? The intention is not vested in anything other than this. Right, so the intention is not vested in a future goal. Now, it takes time and it takes practice. It's not like, okay, well, I got it, now I can do it. Because of the strong perpetual force of karma, right? It does take time. We have very strong habits. We have to recognize that, right? We have to know what we are working with, what we're dealing with. Right, so yes, right intention, very important, right? It's not vested. And it's also not about the self, right? It's not about you. As Myogen was saying, it's about others, right? So I'm here, and then by being here, I can be of service to others. I can pay attention. How do I pay attention, right? How do I pay attention if I'm not, if I'm partially somewhere else, or my attention is elsewhere, right? So if I'm here, I'm paying attention, I'm seeing what's going on, I'm seeing somebody who needs something, and I rise to the occasion and meet that and give if I can, right? But I gotta find a way to come back and stay here. Anyone else?
Can I talk?
Yes, you can talk.
So I think this may have to do with my you know, my Jewish background and my idea that it's incumbent upon us to make the world a better place. But I feel like, you know, okay, no attachments, whatever. I feel a sense of, with Zen tradition at least, there's this beautifully ordered thing. Like even the art that's behind you, you know, the empty circle and the garden that I have, this ice cream saver thing. And I just feel like, okay, here we are, we're a bunch of people, we're all sitting on cushions, doing this incredibly organized, you know, we just did Zazen and chanting, and everything is just very peaceful and very calm. You know, everybody speaks in turn, and it's just, everything is just so peaceful. And I especially feel it when we go to DBZ for position. I've talked about this before, I feel like it's like going up the mountain, coming down the mountain. How could I not be attached to that order of perfect peace in a place where there's like beautiful trees and flowers and a lake, and like, how could I not be attached to that as a place for everybody to live it together harmoniously, like in perfect harmony with nature and all that stuff?
Right. Thank you, Kakua. So, right, how can I not be attached? And if you connect that to what he's saying you can't help it but feel attached, right? So that's the point, right? We can't help it because that's how the mind thinks. Our mind works this way, right? So now, okay, we get that. But then further examination, further deepening practice, also examining where does this come from, right? Is it location or situational based or induced? Is it because of what we have behind us? Is it because we have some organizational aspects to the practice? Or because we chant together? Or because we hug each other, right? What is it? Where does it come from? Or we have to ask, is all this reminding us of something that's always there? Right? Now, having a structure, that's where structure is actually great upaya, is very skillful, because it serves as a reminder. It serves as a way, as a path, inwardly, so we can realize that what you just said, is actually in us, regardless of the circumstances, whether they are chaotic or calm and organized. Now, that doesn't mean we're not gonna, you know, of course, it's absolutely fine to prefer to be in a calm and organized place than a chaotic place, right? That's fine. As long as you're okay with letting that go when you find yourself in a chaotic environment. If you cannot let that go, there is a problem. And then you use the practice as poison, not as medicine. You see, the practice is medicine. Yeah.
Well, so in my mind, and because, you know, I'm trying to create in my mind the empty circle or like the Zen, I'm trying to create DBZ in my mind, but someplace that's totally peaceful and quiet so that I can be a bodhisattva of compassion and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, so I have to work at that, and I think therefore I have to be kind of attached to the idea of calm, peace, compassion.
Right.
Like, right, in that way, in New York, it's just not going to happen.
Well, not only that, it's wasted effort. So Glenn mentioned right. This is wasted effort because it doesn't work. Not only that, it doesn't work and it leads to a great deal of frustration because it doesn't work, right? So well, you've tried it, you know it doesn't work. Then why?
Well, I know that I feel calm after session. I mean, everybody knows the great feeling after session, right? We all know that, don't we?
Absolutely. Well, most. I should say. But the great feeling after Sesshin has nothing to do with Sesshin. That you have to realize. It has nothing to do with Sesshin, because if you did not have the capacity to feel this way, you will never feel this way, Sesshin or not. The capacity is in you all the time. You just don't trust it. Or you have to find your way to tap it, we can say, right? But there was no way you will experience any of it if you did not have already the capacity before you drive up the mountain.
Mm.
Right? It's not, you know, no, it's not the food. Food's great, but it's not the food. Right?
It's not the zazen. I always think it's the zazen.
But what is the zazen? Zazen is a gate. Zazen is nothing. It's a gateway. Right? It's a way for you to be with you. Right? Is a way for you to be with the original you. Right? So Kakuo turns to Kakuo. How's that?
Okay.
Right? So then there you are. Does it matter? So you're over there, right, in New York, and we're here in Wyckoff. But here we are, right? We cut through time and space. Right? We feel each other. We connect with one another. What is that teaching us? Right? What is that teaching us about the gaps of time and space? They're meaningless, right?
Well,
so
we have to make some effort.
You have to make effort. Yeah.
The effort to get here.
Yes, you have to.
Here, then it's done.
We have to make effort. We have to make continuous effort, but also be gentle and consistent. We show up.
Yeah.
You know, we show up. You know how the mind tells you, don't do this, don't do that. It's too early, it's too late. It's too much this, not enough that, right? You look at your mind, you say, okay, that's fine. You can say that.
It's
Right.
You can say that, right? I'm just going to observe you. I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not going to, I'm just going to observe you. Right? Mm-hmm. So the big guy, say again?
That just observing breaks the wheel of samsara?
Yes. Well, we're going to keep reading, but yes, it cuts through the perpetual motion or this, forward motion of karmic patterns. Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was good. Thank you.
I was thinking observing with kindness.
Observing with kindness, yes.
Because I found out.
Yes.
Because I used to sit, I'd go to retreats, I'd go on to the weekly thing, and then I started focusing. And focusing showed me that I thought I was sitting there just to, observing, but there was a quality of aggression.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought it was pure observing, but it wasn't.
No, but that's what he's saying. We can't help it.
No, we can't help it. But then.
Right.
But then we can learn little things.
Yes, we can learn to be gentle. Right, you can. One second. We can learn to be gentle observing what is very aggressive.
Yes.
Right? Not demanding the aggressive to be gentle, but taking responsibility to cultivate a post from which we can observe from kindness.
But it happened because what was for me a new upaya that I was lucky enough that I had a different experience.
Right.
So it's like you have to have an experience and feel the contrast
yes.
between your typical pattern mm-hmm. and something that's different. Not everybody who goes to Shashin thinks it's wonderful.
No.
Some people feel totally trapped. That's their pattern.
Right.
So, kakuo, for you it's liberating, but for some other people, I mean, we're different.
Right. Right, exactly. We have to work with it. We have to work with what rises in us. Right, it's very deeply personal and intimate, mm-hmm. most intimate practice you can practice, right, or path you can be on. It is only about your experiences.
And when you encounter that intimate sense of intimacy,
yeah.
then you feel free, or life feels full.
Right.
Instead of barren.
Because the freedom that you describe has to do with you dealing with your own obstacles, right? So your own barriers, your own hindrances. You're not going to work with somebody else's hindrances. That's not going to lead to freedom, right? It may have led to freedom for this person, but not for you. So you have to encounter, so karmic entanglements are very personal, very right? They're very intimate, it's right? So we have to work with that. Then there is a sense of liberation. And it's a sense of liberation that can last, right? Because it's real, it's true. It's not emulating or vicarious kind of practice, right? Which sometimes we do and we have to shake off. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, in response to the kindness thing,
yeah.
reminded of our kitten. It's not the kitten's fault. It's not the kitten's fault that she's biting our ankles. But how we respond to the biting the ankles is
yes.
really...
Right, she's teething and yes, so she's biting anything.
So she's biting her. But the point is, she's doing something and you're frustrated and it's like, oh my God, it hurts, you know. But then you want to be with kindness, you just want to be like, well, she can't help it. Let's see what we can do. Let's see how I can
Right,
help.
And not kick her, yes. So
that
right.
Happen.
No.
Not too often.
No, in our house, but I don't know.
Certainly
not potential. Anyone else on Zoom that wanted to chime in before we keep going? We're good. You good?
Wear boots.
Wear boots. Yes, in the house in the summer. Okay, so.
She's getting over it.
So he's saying the desire to be saved, become enlightened, or even to develop basic sanity, those ego-oriented types of mentality have to be included as stepping stone, right? So we use it. As we grow and as we develop our approach to meditation with this particular type of meditation is a very simple one. It has nothing to do with becoming greater or higher or more powerful. The Buddhist approach is simply to make the available material in our mind part of the field of our awareness, right? We just talked about Sugyoku, right? That we include everything so that we can work on it. And in the beginning, you okay with this? Okay. In the beginning, the meditator generally works on relating with the discursive thoughts, memories of the past, and ambitions for the future. The meditator works with all of that using a very simple technique that does not suggest anything. The technique is a frame of reference that serves purely as a source of discipline. One tries to work with whatever is available and tries to go along with the energy and the rhythm without trying to change it or make it into something purposeful, right? So what he said, the technique is a framework of reference, it's purely as a source of discipline. Does that make sense? Is that understandable? Or do we need to clarify anything here? If you on Zoom, feel free to unmute if you have a question about that. Yeah? Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, sure. You want more?
Okay, so if you sit down and do nothing, the only thing that is moving is the breath, right? If you sit down and do nothing, the only thing that's moving is the breath, right? So when we practice stillness, the only thing that's moving is the breath, which goes on constantly, obviously. If you're walking, the steps you take out the only thing that's happening. If you're sitting and doing absolutely nothing, the constant alternating of breathing in and out is the only thing going on. It's a very simple approach. There is nothing mystical about it. There is an intangible aspect of breathing that is connected with the mind. At the same time, the ordinary tangible aspect of mind sustains your body. So breath builds a bridge between the mind and the body, right? We have talked about that at different times, right? It's a gateway, right? The breathing becomes a gateway. It's a very straightforward, it is very straightforward. While we are meditating, we find that the overlapping of thoughts interferes constantly. We are still dwelling on the karmic situation or on being goal-oriented. And the very meditative discipline that we take on ourselves is also karmic creation. Further karmic situations go on and on constantly, right? So even the fact that we have found meditation appealing, right, that we are drawn to zazen, for example, to the practice, is by itself a karmic ridden, right, or perpetuated, right? We got to where we got to because of what happened in the past, right? So we have to understand that even becoming interested, which may be a good thing, obviously, right? Or we can see it as a good thing, but still we have to understand, use it to understand the way karma works. And then it says, nevertheless, the approach to meditation is somewhat designed to experience life as it is, beyond spiritual materialism, beyond the goal-oriented attitude of ego. Meditating isn't particularly a big deal. So you shouldn't make a big deal about what happens in your meditation. Very important point, right? So sometimes often people say, you know, I said I got deep into my practice and I experienced this and that light and this incredible opening. Great, keep going, right? The advice is, and it's the same advice, actually, where, you know, somebody comes and says, I feel stuck in my practice. I feel like I'm going nowhere. I feel like I'm regressing. This is not for me, or whatever. Great, keep going. It's the exact same advice. It's not that we are chasing after those incredible lights and colors or whatever and shapes. And no, whatever comes, comes. Whatever goes, goes, right? It's the equanimous approach that's most important, developing an equanimous approach or outlook or view at all things, internally, externally. So what he's saying here, it doesn't matter what happens, don't make a big deal of this. It is a part of your daily existence. Like he's giving example, you wouldn't make a big deal about having had breakfast or the fact that you brushed your teeth this morning. Right? It's like you go, so I brushed my teeth today. Great. Right? So when we take the attitude that can relate with situations directly and simply, without any distortion, a sense of freedom arises and a sense of joy becomes almost automatic. Right? Again, I'm going to read that again. When we take the attitude that we can relate with situations directly and simply, without any distortion, without trying to manipulate life, right? A sense of freedom arises and a sense of joy becomes almost automatic. From that level, our practice develops and we begin to break through. We don't have to put too much emphasis on the discipline or on the goal, because the environment, the world, is becoming workable and less threatening. The simplicity of living situations becomes more obvious. Because of that, we develop a further sense of freedom. We could extend, we could relax. Discipline becomes a natural part of energy rather than feeling like a limitation to our actions. So the situation develops on and on. When we begin to realize that the techniques are not the saving grace, but that the feeling that being familiar with the whole being provides a state of peacefulness, then we don't have to improvise out of our aggression or out of our speed. Right? Because we're not tethered to that anymore, right? We don't need to employ the spiritual materialistic approach. We begin to tame our basic nature and aggression begins to turn into non-violent state of being, right? We talked about taming the ox last Sunday. That's what that means, right? So do you experience that at times? And we're not quantifying how often and for how long, but in your sitting, in your practice, do you have moments, periods of feeling that? Yeah.
I think so, yeah, for sure. And it's interesting, I think the rub of this is, I think your first impulse might be to either attribute success to Zazen. Mm-hmm. Of it's the Zazen's fault. And I think some of that is because maybe people come, what brings an individual to meditation is often looking for a solution to whatever they're experiencing or whatever it is. It's just kind of, it's interesting because I don't know if I've had a lot of difficulty with sitting. I've had a lot of success with sitting, whatever that means. But I don't think I've ever sat there and said, I know what the problem is. I need to stop meditating because it's not working anymore. It's often related to other things that I'm doing and creating a lot of suffering in my life because, I don't know, maybe it's also the nature of this particular form of, you know, of just sitting where there's no bells and whistles and there's no toys. To like, oh, you know what, it'll make your Zazen deeper if you focus on this mantra or something. And that's not me like trying to say anything negative about anybody. You know, there's many roads that lead to Rome, as it were, but it's more just like it's very unadorned and it's just sitting. And so the issue isn't finding the right mantra or the right focus or anything. It's just sitting. And so it really depends on how, to go back to what you were saying earlier about how are we cultivating the land that allows us to receive this. And oftentimes we might attribute the issue to Zazen because we're not ready to see the issue directly in front of us being us in some capacity or whatever limitations we're applying to us.
Right.
We're very quick to place on something else.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I remember during one session, I mean, it's happened in a few sessions to a certain extent, but during one session that we were in, it was just two solid days of intense pain in my knees. And it just would not go away. I was like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? I don't know why I'm doing this, right? It hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And then all of a sudden there was this moment when something inside me said, I don't know what it was, but something inside me said, stop being so hard on your suffering. It's not supposed to be there. No, it's supposed to be there. Don't be so hard on it. And at that very moment, I was able to sit up straight and all the pain in my knees went away. It was like, you know, it was a miracle. No, but it was really intense. That feeling like, why am I so hard on that?
Yeah.
You know, so I've had both experiences at the same time.
Right, so we can relate that to the simple, without any distortion attitude.
Yeah, so I'm suffering, I'm hurting, ow, ow, ow. Instead of that, it's like, okay.
Right, so what kind of, let's stay with that for a few more minutes. He's saying here, when we take the attitude that can relate with situations directly and simply, without any distortion, a sense of freedom arises and a sense of joy becomes almost automatic.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean, to relate to things?
That is kind of what she's saying about kind of blending with the situation. Because suffering is separation. So we are always separating this kind of moment of knee pain or something that doesn't go the way we want it to go. And we separate that that's what's going on, and then we, of course, we don't want to have the pain. And that separation creates the whole suffering, and we cannot perpetuate it, and we don't even realize that, you know, many times, even though we say it all over again, and even though we may be practicing like in Sasen, or
right.
We may be practicing every day, we really don't realize that it just takes the moment of saying, all right, I'm gonna accept this reality and just kind of connect, merge, be that reality. And it did happen to me recently that I had like not a physical pain, but like a kind of an internal pain of my plans not going the way I wanted it to go. And they had like learned a couple of news that I was like, oh my God, this is like,
mm-hmm.
this is not going the way I wanted. And,
mm-hmm.
and I had like days of doom,
mm-hmm.
you know, doom. And they're kind of,
resume.
Yeah, and the doom is strong. And I guess, I mean, like, you know, the practice, long years of practice, you know, I keep going with the doom and not paying attention to it,
mm-hmm.
like I'm not kind of going into it too much, but like it was there until
right.
one day I was like, why don't this just kind of accept that this is gone,
mm-hmm.
like and then it's a mourning period,
mm-hmm.
like that's
mm-hmm.
how I call it,
mm-hmm.
like sometimes we need to mourn something, and that mourning period is very hard to just let go very instantaneously, but the sooner we can finish the mourning and accept the loss of whatever kind of separation we have, the
mm-hmm.
more we connect, and that's what he's saying.
Right.
Maybe in a more sophisticated way, but like what he's saying is that, yeah, the moment that you connect, then it feels phenomenal. And it's true. I mean, I felt it when I accepted it. It
right.
was like, it was a moment when I heard something else and I was like, you know, that's it. And then the moment I accepted it, it was like the sun shining again. The doom went away, and it's like, okay, so now
right.
I know, I mean, now I can keep going, because I mean, before it was like, it was in the blizzard.
Oh, that's
you know?
Why the sun came out.
Yeah.
right, so yes, that's connecting very well with not manipulating, not distorting, right? But meeting reality, we talked about this last time, like a couple weeks ago, meeting reality on reality's terms. Meeting reality in reality's terms. I don't like it. I have my own terms, right? That's what we say. And I don't like. right? But then shifting that to meeting, and that's the simplicity. Because the reality is actually very simple. We may not like what it's saying or doing, but it is simple nonetheless, right? It's very simple. It's just doing this, doing that, right? That's it. So if we can, you know, in the moment, right? If we can align with that, that's what he's saying, you know, just simply relate with situations directly as is, direct approach or direct communication with reality. On the language of reality, with the language of reality, not our own language. Right? So, actually, Mazumi Roshi called that reading should be done, he said, in practice through reality, in reality way, or reality reading. Right? So then you read it from within with an affinity or connection with reality, being on the same wavelength. Right? So it's not you reading, it's you experiencing what you read. You're not trying to memorize it or understand it. You're reading it as the words that you read. They read, right? You read the words and you become that. Right? So, yeah, distortion and clarity. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on like that moment of distortion, like, you know, whenever you're aligned and you're set with it, where we begin to distort is when we want to pick or choose on one side or the
right.
other. When you were mentioning the sun, it reminded me this morning, as soon as I sat down this morning, the sun out of this window was popping in. It's lovely that the sun's out here, but then all of a sudden I was like, well, that's really bright. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I think I'm gonna get hot. And that moment moved me off this cushion for half a second or whatever. So it's really those senses of preferences, and when we notice them, that move us out of that.
Very true.
I've had those
bliss tricks on us.
And that's what he means by karmic situation, is that getting into that cause and effect cycle of, you know, this is going to lead to that and this is going to lead to that, instead of...
Right, so coming back...
Trying to get out of that karmic situation.
Right, cutting through that is residing or basking in the simplicity of the moment. And seeing the moment as plenty sufficient for nurturing you. You don't need more than that.
But I'm going to get sweaty. And I'm going to do this. And I'm going to do that.
Right.
It is insistent.
Right. That's what then, you know, so shifting from futurizing to being. Right? That's futurizing. I will. Right? But again, then I'm dealing with something that's not happening, right? But I'm dealing with it nonetheless, and then there is a gap. There's a problem. How do I deal with something that's not happening? Right? How can
also,
I?
We don't know.
We don't know, right? You may
like,
not.
We really don't know. Like, I had like a meeting on Friday, and in preparation for that meeting, I was like, okay, so I need to say these, which is not an easy, it wasn't an easy meeting. It was like, we were kind of disconnecting the contract we were having, like it wasn't an easy meeting. And I was like, kind of thinking about it and thinking how to do it, blah, blah, blah. And it spent like hours in my head thinking about this and that. And then we came to the meeting and this person that we were going to disconnect with, she's like, you know, like I don't feel like I'm a good fit. I will just kind of, it's, you know, I was like, okay. So she kind of realized that we were not really a good fit, and I didn't need to go through any of my pains of whatever we were going to do. And so, I mean, again, I don't think I shouldn't have prepared anyway, because I didn't know. But I didn't. What I'm saying is that we get so caught up with the futuristic impressions of what we get. I mean, how long the sun may be going to be. I mean, is the sun going to make you sweaty really, really? Maybe not. Maybe it's just shifting, and then you don't see it anymore. And like, and
right.
We get like in caught up with a lot with that.
Yeah.
And kind of how, and defining those things sometimes is good. I mean, sometimes they're kind of the most concerning ones for me are the most unclear effects. So I mean, the things that I fear that I don't know why I'm fearing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a sensation that this is wrong for me. I don't know why. I don't know what the impact is, but it's bad. And so that helps a lot to kind of, again, and kind of keep going, accept it, and like kind of go inward and try to figure out where is that,
mm-hmm.
that is kind of calling the ring, and how can I mitigate it if possible. But yeah, so I think the whole separation is like very clear there.
Yeah.
How do we separate?
Right.
Like how do we
gaps are painful.
Gaps are painful, yeah.
Right. So I'll go back to reading some more. When a non-violent state of being develops, Fushin. Okay, sorry about that. Go ahead, Fushin.
Jump right in.
Thank you.
I'm just going to take a moment. I was struck with something about the way Wukun said "just sitting," and I looked up "just" because I'm a word nut. So, just exactly, precisely. Absolutely, completely, totally, entirely, perfectly, utterly, wholly, thoroughly, altogether, in every way, in all respects, quite down to the ground.
Yeah. That's good. So Shikantaza, right? Just sitting. Right? So that's the just sitting. That's the just, right? There's nothing else going on. Thank you. So, when a non-violent state of being develops, we push less, fight less. Then we can begin to relate to nowness, this very now. Before, we didn't relate with nowness in our meditation. We simply tried to see the ordinary quality of things as they are. But as we become familiar with that, those ordinary situations become now situations. Right, so they come to life, actually. Certain tantric teachings talk about the fourth moment, a state of nowness that transcends past, present, and future as well. In that experience, nowness is not even a point of reference. Rather, there is no reference point at all. And this is actually the aim of Shikantaza. That's what it's about. We are simply being right there. We can afford to open. We can afford to forget the threat. We don't have to repeat the past through our memories or projections of the future. We can just be open and straightforward. At this point, for a moment, the meditator sows no seeds of karma. Right? At that point, the meditator sows no seeds of karma. The impulse comes back to sow further seeds. But then there is another moment where you sow no seeds. There is a gap that boycotts the karmic force. Then the karmic force comes back. Both the non-planting force and the karmic force come back again and again. So we are planting seeds, sowing seeds all the time. But as we begin to see the nowness, as we cut through, right, we sow fewer and fewer seeds. That gap becomes more and more definite. It happens more often. There is more space. There's actually more space, right? So, and very important point, right? Because to get away from the linear idea of progression, right? So relating that to the 10 ox herding, which we talked about last Sunday, right? So there are 10 steps of realization, right? Spiritual path. Yes, there are the descriptions, but we should not get caught up in I'm moving from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, right? I can experience what the 10 ox herding picture is portraying one moment or one day, and then the next day experience what the first one is portraying. And it's not wrong. It's just the way it is. It's not wrong, right? Because it's not linear. Because essentially, we're not going anywhere, so how could it be linear? We're not going anywhere, we're not going anywhere. So all those experiences are happening now. So sometimes we experience now fully, right? And we step away from that past, present, future line or timeline. And then other times we get caught up in the past, present, future timeline. And that's what he's saying here is natural. But another important thing is that he's saying is that the more you practice, the less this happens and the more this happens. you find it more available. Or we can say that you find your way back quicker. Is that something we can relate to? Or do we relate to that? So, Yosin, go ahead, nod and speak.
I like just nodding.
I know.
I think it is that, you know, I entered practice because I had a lot of anxiety. You know, same sort of thing, that karmic experience that like ends up being the roots of where you get here, then you realize those roots are a path, are there steps to the place you are now.
Mm-hmm.
I also was one that thought this would be the answer that solves my anxiety. My anxiety still is there, it just serves differently. Mm-hmm. So whereas before it might blow me off path or knock me down,
mm-hmm.
that sense of balance is recognizing and using it for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, right. So that's what I said at the end, creating more space, the end of that paragraph, right? When you create more space, the anxiety that you describe is still there, but it's not as predominant. It's not as loud.
It's
because there's more space. Exactly.
Right.
Because it's not overcrowding.
Right.
That's the idea of space, right? The more space there is, the less overcrowded we feel by situations and by people or by our own experiences. Right? Just create space. And creating space also is not exactly what we're doing, because we're not creating anything, right? We are experiencing or realizing what's already there. So space is there. Ample amount of space. Right? I mean, right? We can't even comprehend the spaciousness of space when we talk about space.
Yeah, most of it.
But yet we feel crowded, which is strange, right? We feel crowded functioning in very spacious environment in terms of space, right? Yeah, thank you. Yes.
No, I was just saying, in terms of space, it's great to make space around it, and then it becomes lighter, and there's more joy in it. So this is what I try to do in my classroom. I should really try it with myself sometimes, but you know, in my classroom, you know, these kids they have emotional and behavioral issues. They have a lot of anxiety, they have a lot of self-doubt, and they're just really down on themselves, and they're really angry sometimes. But I find when those moments come, when they start getting, like, you see the cloud coming, right? And in those moments when you see the cloud coming, you stop and you say, what's really happening here, you know? So I'm like, I stop them from that path, and then I'll make a joke about it, and then they'll start laughing. And then they won't even remember that their anger, you know, their anger was overtaking them, or their pain was overtaking them, you know? And then there's just laughter in the room,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's really nice to do that. I would just, you know, I would love to do that for myself, because I take everything in a very heavy way. That's why Doom resonated with me, because it's just like, no.
Right, and that's definitely comic, right? It's comic
yeah.
in nature,
yeah.
which we have to ask, how do I make space for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do I make space for that particular kind of reactivity, right? And that's where it's extremely personal.
Right.
The whole thing is extremely personal.
That's also why the analogy they often use with this is about dissolving it rather than pushing it or destroying
right.
it, because
right.
it's still there. And it's interesting, because I've had moments like that where I feel the anger coming in and somebody will break it up with a joke and I'm able to let it go, but there's still a part of me that's holding on going like, why am I dismissing this? Like,
right.
this is still a real thing for me, and
right.
I can laugh at it, but there's still a part of me that's going like this really frustrates me.
Right.
Like, why do I feel so down on myself or whatever it is, and I'm still holding on to it because I feel like I have to crush it and then be done with it, but in reality it's just I'm dissolving it
right.
in whatever water it is, and so it's like I can still make sense of it and allow it to I see it coming in and I can greet it differently
yeah.
without dismissing it. I think that's
right, right, right. Nothing needs to be dismissed. It's,
yeah.
Well, we have to get to a point that, you know, we understand nothing needs to be dismissed.
Right.
Because I'm okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just like that, right?
The bread needs to rise.
Yeah.
Right, there could be a misunderstanding here, he says. So I'm just going to keep reading a bit. I don't mean to say that nowness is absence of discursive thoughts, exactly what we just talked about, right? Rather, it is that discursive thoughts or any kind of emotional thoughts one might have been given lots of room, lots of space to function, right? So nothing is bumping against anything, right? So they don't have to fight for their territory anymore. Right, and in a way, you know, focusing touches on that too, right? You know, you're not resisting anything. So when you're not resisting something, it stops fighting you. If you resist it, it will fight you if you push against. But if you develop that kind attitude towards everything unconditionally, then things naturally relax, right? Not because you shout at them, because you tell them it's okay, you can be here. Right, and that non-fighting creates that sense, what he's describing. So lots of space to function, so they don't have to fight for the territory anymore. Nowness is a state without struggle. Nowness is a state without, being is actually a state without struggle, right? So it's not that we experience it all the time, obviously, but that being that we are practicing is a state without struggle, without resistance. Struggle comes from feeling that you are lacking something, right? We talked about that before. You need to get something further out of your life. When there is nothing lacking and no territory for the discursive thoughts to fight for, no crowded situation for them to struggle through anymore, the discursive thoughts have fewer repercussions. There is less reference to the past or the future, so the situation becomes much more self-existing. Less reference to the past and the future. That by itself, that line, that cuts through karma, right? Less reference to the past and the future, meaning I am not going to define myself or be defined by what happened, and I am not going to be defined by my hopes for the future or fears of the future. I refuse to be defined. Then we come to life. Now he's quoting from Suzuki. Suzuki Roshi said that the way to control your cow is to give it plenty of room to graze. This is the same idea, right? He talks about the mind. Suzuki talked about the mind. You want to give your, so if you have a herd of sheep, right, you give them a lot of space to graze. This is the same idea, the same principle. As long as there is no demand, as long as there is no territory involved, then confusion becomes orderly chaos. Interesting way to see that. Orderly chaos. Or order and chaos are non-dual. Right? That's another way to understand that. Right? If I see what Kako was talking about, right? I see order over there and chaos over there, then of course I want that, because that's orderly, that's nice, that's quiet, people are nice to me, and over there, not so much, right? And this is one of the, I think, more challenging dualities for us to cut through, right? And it makes perfect sense why it's difficult for us to, why would be difficult for us to cut through, why we want the calm. Yeah?
I have a question.
Sure.
So it's about experience. So there's no difference between order and chaos, and so we're not preferring one to the other. It seems to me, or maybe I hope, that our experience is that there's something else. We have an experience of something that is neither order nor chaos, but is sustained. Do you know what I mean?
That's the space he's talking about. It's the space that allows for chaos when chaos comes and for quiet and calm when quiet and calm come.
So as long as you are in touch with that space, connecting with that space in this moment, then it seems that order, that you don't need to prefer order or chaos.
No, it doesn't mean that. It means you're okay with having the preferences it's okay to want to go there versus there. As long as you understand that there and there, here and there are the same, then you can have that preference. You're free to have the preference. Either way, we have preferences. That's not in question. The question is, am I free with my preferences or not? Right? So that's when the attachment becomes the issue, not the preference. Right? Because you go somewhere, they don't have what you want, and then what do? How do you respond? How do you react to that? Or the day did not turn out the way you preferred it would. Then what do you do? That's where this is, when we applied, the most important moments to apply practice is a moment like that, right? When what we want did not materialize. Right? Because if practice is not applied there and then what are we doing? Right? Because that will create further a neurosis, as he says, or not. Right? Because if I'm accepting it immediately or as quick as possible, then I'm not going to create further karma. If I'm fighting it, I'm fighting it from karma. Right? I'm using the ingredients of karma to fight it. Then I'm going to feel the same. Right? Yeah. Thank you for that. So, let me see. You don't have to create... So what he's saying here, it talks about space. Now let me just go back a little bit. At that very moment, there is no sowing of seeds of karma. At the very moment, there are no memories involved. In the state of nowness, we are not recording our memories as part of a case history or as part of akshanic records, like records of everything that happened since the beginning of time. Whatever you will call it, but of course there is intelligence about what is happening. Often the idea of saving a memory is that you deliberately record something and put it aside as reinforcement for the future. Here, in terms of nowness, there is no such thing happening because you're not threatened anymore. You don't have to create the space. Space is not a product of anything, as we just discussed. It is a question of opening to the situation of space, opening to the situation or to the fact that this is the way it is. The space is already there. So you don't have to manufacture it. Since it's already there and it was never created, the experience of space is self-existing and self-perpetuating. Within the space of nowness, there's also no sense of split, no sense of duality. At that very moment of now, there is no ignorance. In the nowness of the gap, spaciousness becomes intelligent. That is the next step. When there is no further sowing of seeds in that moment, spaciousness becomes not just the absence of seeds, but it becomes intelligent and functional, obviously, right? Because it becomes very beneficial. Compassion, communication, and gentleness all arise from that openness. When we realize that we don't have to be all that aggressive and poised to fight anymore, we can afford to just be. The creative aspect of being comes along with that basic sense of being. The creative aspect of being comes along with that sense of being, right? So that sense of being, right, from that connectedness with nothingness or spaciousness, creativity naturally manifests. Because we're not vested in anything, we're not trying to protect anything anymore. So, yeah, we'll finish with that. Any thoughts or questions about that? Jifu, yes.
I'm feeling confused.
Yeah.
Which is almost all I want to say. But what is shikantaza?
Shikantaza means just sitting, right? Just sitting. That's the literal translation, right? And what we talked about before, right, in the description I went through, that's a description of shikantaza, right? So we're not vested in anything, right? So if you look at zazen, for example, right, you can practice different kinds of zazen. You can do breath practice, right? You can work with a koan, right? You can presence the moment, or you can practice shikantaza, right? And in shikantaza, you're not practicing anything in particular. You're just completely being, right? So there is nothing, there's no before, there's no after. There's no this either, right? Because everything is totally integrated, totally connected. So you, right, sitting on a cushion is no longer you sitting on a cushion. Because there's no you and there's no cushion to sit on. Okay? Thank you. Anyone else? We got a couple of minutes to wrap it up. Shingyo, you wanted to say something? Or you are absorbing.
Love the idea of shikantaza.
Don't love it too much.
I was thinking about how we walking dogs and how that became a big part of my daily practice and so meditative, even though I'm not sitting on the cushion, but just that experience of completely being in the moment.
Yeah, it's bliss. Yes, raise on.
Let's see, Yoko was saying about order and chaos. It seems that order and chaos cannot help but be our ideas of order and chaos. And so there are always limited ideas of order and chaos.
Right.
I've been thinking of context, the context that we think we're in, the context that we might create as ways of limiting space to something that's manageable.
Right.
That there's too much space, I think, for most of us, most of the time, and we need to construct ways to cut it down.
Right.
And then find order within those cut down ways of minimizing space. And that, I think what we've been discussing about the practice is ways of trying to enlarge that and try to get bigger perspectives in it, which, usually, really, we've been watching too much television lately because they keep saying fuck on television. Really fucks up the notion of order. We have this nice notion of order, and then we screw it up by increasing the context. So that dynamic of keep trying to increase the range, the picture, the context, and the realization that wherever we're at is very much a construction, which is limiting us.
Right. You're saying chaos and it's quiet, right? It reminds me, when I was young, we lived in the city, and then we moved to a much more quiet place. And my father said, you know, he has tough time falling asleep. He said, he was joking, he said, I need to turn on the blender to fall asleep. So... Right, it's very personal, right? What we call chaos or what we call calm is absolutely personal, right? You know, for some people it's this, for others that. So, which is good to note, right? Or to acknowledge, because then it takes it away from the solidity of it, right? The absoluteness of calm and chaos, right? In our mind, it's absolute, but in reality, it's extremely relative and personal. Right, everybody, right, exactly. That's why we don't seem to get along. Right? Because everybody walks around with their own ideal and you get in their way. Right? Because you don't think the same. Yeah, we got to wrap it. You want to quickly? Go ahead.
I was just going to say what scientists, astrologists used to think of as, used to think of as the universe constantly seeking order. And it's just not true that they're finding that the universe is just this constant creation. And so it's a constant balance between order and chaos. And one is neither good or bad.
Yeah, one is the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, thank you. Let's finish full vows.
Bodhisattva Vows, page 1. Bodhisattva Vows for all. cosmos strong.